Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of November, and it's all things political. We always air this on Mondays at 1 o'clock. Our focus this hour on three large issues that may be decided by courts. One is currently under deliberation. President Obama, in his address to the nation on Thursday, announced executive action that would allow about 4 million undocumented immigrants who have lived in America for at least 5 years to apply for a program to protect them from removal. Does the president have such legal authority? Number two, in the most serious challenge to President Obama's health care law since it survived the Supreme Court by a single vote in 2012, this case will be heard in March, and it concerns the meaning of four words in the Affordable Care Act. And the Ferguson grand jury, which you heard about during the NPR news, which has been meeting for a long time considering charges against white police officer Darren Wilson, who shot an unarmed black teen, Michael Brown. Our guest this hour knows all about the law, and that's why we are looking at legal issues. His name is Akhil Reed Amar. He's joined us before on this program for All Things Political. Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, teaches constitutional law at both Yale College and Yale Law School. He clerked for Judge Stephen Breyer for the U.S. Court of Appeals, joined the Yale faculty in 1985, co-editor of a leading constitutional law casebook, and author of several books, including The Constitution and Criminal Procedure, First Principles, America's Constitution, a biography, and most recently, America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Amar. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you are always welcome to read comments. We like to read comments from you after the show, and we're on Twitter as well at @KDunnShow. Just a reminder, hour two of our program today, Senator John McCain will join us, co-author of 13 Soldiers, A Personal History of Americans at War. Professor Akhil Reed Amar, thank you very much for joining us again. Hello.
Thank you for having me. Happy Thanksgiving week.
And thank you to you as well. I love Thanksgiving, always one of my favorite holidays.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the president's address on executive action on immigration last Thursday, and lots of cries, mostly from Republicans, that the president does not have legal authority for this. What do we know about the law in immigration and the Constitution in immigration?
Well, what we know is that although you described it as executive action, in a way it's inaction. It's just not doing anything, and he's not done it before, and his predecessors haven't done it. What he's basically saying is, at least on his watch, he can't deport everyone. He doesn't have enough money and resources to do it. Congress hasn't allocated enough money. And so what he has said is, given that they don't have enough money to deport everyone, and that wouldn't be very sensible anyway, at least on my watch, here are the people that are not at risk of deportation. I'm basically not going to do a certain thing. It's sometimes called prosecutorial discretion, but I think that's a little bit misnamed. One, this is not a criminal context, so it's not really about prosecution the way in, say, Ferguson, Missouri, which we'll talk about later, that's criminal. So it's really not quite prosecution, and it's actually not so much prosecution as non-prosecution. It's inaction. So really, he's basically saying he doesn't have enough money to go after everyone, and so certain people on his watch are safe. Hmm. If after an election, if you vote for someone else, they can go after those people, perhaps.
Hmm. Well, he did deport a huge number of people, didn't he?
He did. Now, I'm not as expert on immigration law as others are, so but based on reports that I've read, he's actually been quite vigorous and active, given the budgetary and other resource constraints.
So those who are critical of his action have said that he's establishing a dangerous precedent that violates fundamental principles of separation of powers.
Well, it would be nice if they explained why, given what I just said. People can say all sorts of stuff, and you know, it's a political environment, hothouse, D.C. We have very sharply polarized parties, much more sharply polarized than really ever before since the Civil War era, at least. But I'm not quite sure where's the beef. You can't enforce all the laws. He's not doing anything that creates a permanent citizenship status. He's not binding his successor. And the resources that Congress has allocated are finite.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't say that, did he?
I think he did in the Office of Legal Counsel memo that accompanied his announcement. It's a very elaborate legal memorandum from some very careful lawyers, and it's available on the web. Your listeners can click on it in 30 seconds. They can find it and read it.
Okay. I don't think too much reporting has been done on that, and thank you for the information. So what do you imagine will happen from here when he challenged Congress, you know, the members who may not like what he has done, pass a bill? He said that over and over, pass a bill, pass a bill. Do you think politically this will encourage Congress to look at this issue and pass a bill, or will it have the opposite effect?
Well, I defended what he's done legally. Now, politically, I'm also a political science professor. Let me sort of try to frame the thing. And then he's playing hardball, and so was the other side. The Senate has passed a bipartisan bill. Republicans and Democrats both voted for an immigration reform plan that got over 70 votes. You can't get over 70 votes unless some Republicans and some Democrats both join in, because neither party has 70 senators. That's passed. What he keeps trying to highlight is that all the House needs to do is take the thing up, that Senate bill, for a vote, and if it were put on the floor, it would pass today, he believes, because some Republicans and almost all Democrats would vote for it, and enough Republicans would actually vote for it to give it a House majority. Now, why hasn't the bill been called up? Because of a thing called the Hastert Rule. It may be misnamed, but Denny Hastert sort of gave his name to this rule. John Boehner doesn't want to put too many bills on the floor for a vote unless there's a majority of Republicans who are in favor of it. That wouldn't be true for immigration reform in the House. It would pass with a majority of the House as a whole, but most Republicans would vote against it. But enough Republicans would probably vote for it to actually make it a law, mm-hmm. and Obama would sign it. And so, in effect, he's trying to say, listen, this is a bipartisan thing. Almost all Democrats and a whole bunch of Republicans are in favor of this in both the House and the Senate. Well, problem solved.
Well, what do you think would have happened? The Republicans have been criticized by Democrats and by a lot of people on TV saying, listen, the Republicans weren't likely to do anything. You may say, the Republicans, that you've poisoned the well here, President Obama, but those on the other side would say, listen, the House isn't going to take up this issue anyhow. You know, this is the only thing that could be done to deal with immigration. Is that criticism right? Would the House have taken this up eventually?
Well, so some of your audience may have heard the phrase wedge issue. Let me try to explain what a wedge issue is. In the same way that, like, a really clever quarterback of, let's say, the Green Bay Packers.
Yes.
I'm pandering to the hometown here.
It's fine.
Trying to split the zone. What you try to do sometimes is identify issues where actually the other party is somewhat divided. That's the wedge. You're driving a wedge actually between different factions of the other party. All your folks on your party believe in something, and the other party is divided. For Republicans, that might be something like Keystone Pipeline. All Republicans are in favor of it, and so are some Democrats. What Obama is trying to say here is actually there are a bunch of Republicans that are in favor of immigration reform. Not all of them, and this is why Boehner doesn't want to put the thing to a vote, because he doesn't want the split in his caucus among Republicans to be visible and obvious. But in fact, this is an issue that actually divides various Republicans. The business wing of the Republican Party that wants just some clear rules about whom they can hire and whom they can't and go forward, and the Tea Party populist wing that is offended that certain people are seeming to jump the line, jump mm-hmm. the queue.
And in terms of the president's thoughts about politics here, was politics a consideration and a major consideration when he decided to act now on this, that he's just not going to leave a legacy of an Affordable Care Act that the Supreme Court will be taking up again, which we'll talk about later? He just needs to, because he took a shellacking in the midterm, show that he's a president who is still engaged and is going to do things if he has to by himself, and thus be making the Democrats appear to be not a party of do-nothings, but a party of let's do something.
So he didn't do it before the election, and he's doing it now. And I think one reason he's doing it now is he is very interested in trying to put the Republicans in a tight spot vis-a-vis the Hispanic vote. The Hispanic vote might very well be decisive. They may be the swing voters in 2016 in the next presidential election if they show up. They didn't really quite show up last month or earlier this month. They sat on their hands. And so he's trying to basically, in some ways, redefine the agenda. He's put something on the agenda that puts the Republicans in a difficult position. Either they offend Hispanics and therefore maybe motivate them to show up in 2016, or they actually have to do something. Which will split their coalition and pit their hard right against their business center.
And you have to wonder, I don't know if Hillary Clinton is the foregone conclusion that she's obviously going to be the presidential candidate in 2016, but whoever that candidate is has to wholeheartedly embrace what the president did in his executive action, right?
And that's what I meant by a wedge issue, because it turns out almost all Democrats support what the president did as a matter of policy, I haven't really heard very many Democrats criticize him for doing it unilaterally. That's the process question. Do we agree with the policy? Yes. We think that there has to be some solution to the problem of all sorts of people who have a legal limbo status. Almost all Democrats believe that, including Hillary Clinton. And none of the Democrats seem to be saying that Obama shouldn't have acted as he did. I believe I saw a quotation from Hillary Clinton wholeheartedly endorsing what Obama has done.
And then the Republicans have the problem of just the humanity of this, because you see so many faces of people who can now, you know, have their parents be open about who they are and have a pathway to becoming citizens themselves. All of these tender-hearted stories from people who have lived here for a long period of time and have done so very secretively and thinking they may be deported at any time. How do the Republicans handle that part of this discussion, because it's significant?
Well, remember, actually, none other than Rick Perry, when he was running for president, actually said that certain kinds of ideas about deporting everyone immediately were heartless. So this is an issue that divides Republicans, actually, in some interesting ways. That's what makes it what I called a wedge issue.
And in terms of the money, you mentioned the president in that legal memorandum talking about he didn't have enough money to deport everybody. The Republicans have also said, well, maybe there won't be enough money for you to implement your executive order.
Well, again, much of what he's doing is a kind of inaction, and inaction takes less resources than action. A lot of what he's doing is just telling us all that he's going to continue not doing what he has been not doing for the last 5 years, which is not deporting all sorts of folks. And in that, he's continuing policies of George W. Bush, who also didn't deport all sorts of folks. So he's giving a label to this. He's putting it on the agenda. He's admitting. He's giving a textual frame for what's been going on for a very long time under presidents of both parties, which is non-deportation of millions of people who are here, strictly speaking, illegally.
We'll move on to other issues, but I want to let our audience know that we'll respond to your phone calls on immigration right after we pause for just a moment. Akhil Reed Amar is our guest. He is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. And we're talking about issues that the courts will be deciding, perhaps, We'll move on to, let's move on to the Ferguson grand jury, because there's all this anticipation. Oh, they're going to announce today the decision or tomorrow, and everybody's tense and they're worried about what the response will be if the officer is not indicted. This whole process of a grand jury is an interesting one, and it's been meeting for a long, long time, considering the charges against Darren Wilson, including evidently his statements about what happened in Ferguson, the shooting, fatal shooting of Michael Brown. So we'll talk about the grand jury and why indeed they may be taking so long, how a grand jury works, who makes up the grand jury if they deliberate totally by themselves, how many witnesses have been heard, and what the political response may be, and it does become worse with every passing day. And we'll talk about the most serious challenge to the Affordable Care Act, since the Supreme Court said that most of it was okay, and they made that decision by just one vote back in 2012. Here is our phone number. Join our All Things Political conversation at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we have a lot of calls coming in on immigration, so let's start with those calls and move on to other subjects in a moment. Chris in Milwaukee is first. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My concern is over the people the president is deporting, specifically criminals and specifically gangsters. In the past, the U.S. has deported gangsters to places like El Salvador, where the locals have no way of dealing with them. And these criminals have caused real havoc where they've been dropped. Is there any bill offering any solutions to this problem?
That's a really great question, Chris. I don't know the answer to that. Our basic point is that we don't want them here, I suppose. But then that really does, and they're not entitled to be here, but that really does raise the question of who will take them? But presumably their home country, that's the country where they belong. And I guess the strict legal argument would be if they had stayed in El Salvador, they might be creating a lot of problems for El Salvador, but we wouldn't have to take them. And since they're here illegally and criminals, back to El Salvador they go.
Mm-hmm. Professor Amar, do you know if this immigration issue has always been a difficult one throughout American history?
Ours has been for many decades, early on, very much of a pro-immigration society. Of the, mm-hmm. the 39 men who signed their names to the Constitution, seven were actually foreign-born. Eight of the 55 who met there, three of the first 10 Supreme Court justices were foreign-born. Four of our first six Secretaries of the Treasury, including Alexander Hamilton and Albert Gallatin, actually were foreign-born. Since Madison, Wisconsin, you know, there's a connection. Madison's big pal was Albert Gallatin, actually. At the beginning, we had a lot of Western lands to sell, and we wanted people to come and buy it and be on our side in the next war. We needed bodies. Time went on, there were anxieties about immigration from certain places. A party called the American Party, the Know-Nothing Party, in the mid-19th century arose anti-immigration from Ireland. And then there was skepticism about Eastern European and Northern Eastern and Southern European immigrants, Jews and Slavs, in the late 19th century and in the 1920s, actually, important immigration restrictions were put in place. There was also anxiety about immigration from China, leading to a set of statutes, the Chinese exclusion statutes. So it's been an issue throughout American
mm-hmm.
history.
Yeah. I did think one of the most effective parts of the president's address was when he talked about how we were all strangers at one point.
That's a biblical reference, of course, to the Old Testament. I was a stranger at your gates, a stranger in a strange land, the folks who know their scripture sort of caught the reference, but it's interesting he didn't identify it as by chapter and verse, maybe in part because not everyone is an Old Testament believer.
Right. Thank you, Chris, for your call. Steve in Arkansas, Wisconsin. Hi.
Guys, thank you for having me. With all due respect, this educated professor or whatever he is,
he's a professor.
Information is what he learned in books. The reality of the situation is we have people from Mexico that were in the drug cartel. They murdered, they raped, they molested children, and there's no paper trail to trace these people's history, their criminal past. There's nothing to tie them in with their past, of their murderous past or rapist past or whatever the case may be. And we're supposed to go believe them when they say that they've never been convicted of any felony or never murdered or raped or molested a child?
Professor Amar.
There are lots. I think one interesting thing that I did hear in President Obama's speech, he played sort of an interesting gender card. He mentioned a young woman named Astrid. He actually sharply contradistinguished between gang members and a mother trying to support. Uh-huh. There are these images out there, but I wouldn't want to presume that all 11 million folks here are somehow criminals. That seems pretty extreme. One thing that we do know is whether they've behaved themselves here in America, because if they haven't, out they go.
I don't know who has numbers on this, but I would imagine there are a number of criminals who have been deported.
President Obama said that he's actually ramped up the deportation of people who have actually committed crimes here in the United States. He's, in effect, saying, you've only given me a certain amount of money. I'm going to spend the money first to get rid of the people who are actually criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And given limited resources, doesn't it make sense to go after them first?
Mm-hmm. Let's move. We can go back to this with phone calls, but let's move to what's going on in Ferguson, where, every day the news is, well, maybe the decision will come today, and there's all this anxiety, and people are worried about what will happen. Can you tell us a little bit about the grand jury process, Professor? It's been going on since August, I understand.
And remember we talked about how immigration, strictly speaking, that's not a criminal process. Even though we talk about prosecutorial discretion, it's prosecution really is a criminal idea, and you see it now in Ferguson. Note a couple things. We're dealing with a state government, not the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
In effect, what's going on is very similar to what I was talking about before, prosecutorial discretion. Even if someone may have committed a crime, every day prosecutors choose not to go after everyone who may have committed a crime. Every day grand juries decide that they're not going to actually go after people again who may have committed crimes. So there isn't actually any legal right that a victim of a crime has to demand a criminal prosecution. No one's rights quite are violated when prosecutors don't go forward, and they don't go forward for all sorts of reasons, because they're not sure that they can prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt in court, because they too have limited resources and they have to go after only the worst actors, because we've actually, not perhaps in this case but in other cases, we've over criminalized. Think about all the people who smoke marijuana, for example, and that's still today a federal crime to possess marijuana in Colorado, but we're not going after those guys because maybe we can't get a Colorado jury to convict. So the grand jury is half of the prosecution system. In effect, prosecution only occurs when both the executive branch, the governor or the attorney general in Missouri, in this case the attorney general, wants to go ahead. But even if the attorney general wants to go ahead, an ordinary group of citizens has to countersign that check. No prosecution begins unless both the professional prosecutor and ordinary citizens, the grand jury in states that have grand juries, say yes. And they can say no for all sorts of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the grand jury is not a transparent process. It's and there are reasons why it's not transparent. And if people want to find out, you know, want to learn a little bit more about why, you know, we don't get to ask them why they did stuff, we could go into that.
I have read that they have been listening to a vast amount of testimony and all kinds of evidence has been presented. I've also read that it's rather unusual that in many cases prosecutors just offer the grand juries very narrowly guided cases. Can you explain why it would be so vast?
Why what would be so vast?
All the evidence, all the testimony, they're just getting a lot of information.
Well, I didn't know that, but presumably, if let me take that as a given. I've learned something. So why might that be so? Well, because this was something that happened on the public streets. Lots of different people may have seen it. People remember things differently. They had different angles on the event, so there are different stories to put together. Also, the law is somewhat complicated because in Missouri, as I understand it, as it's been described to me by other journalists, the criminal law rules for police officers are not as strict as the criminal law rules for other folks. And so a police officer in Missouri is allowed to shoot even, or at least is not a criminal when he shoots even someone who's not posing an immediate threat to him. His rules of engagement, his rules of criminal self-defense are actually different than the private citizens under Missouri criminal law.
Mm-hmm. And what do you worry about? Obviously, everybody worries that there will be protests all over the place, maybe extending beyond Ferguson. We've had other instances in recent American history where there have been cases that the results have meant an explosion in demonstrations and sometimes in violence. Two questions. By having this be so long, does it make the possibility of that happening even more likely? And can you imagine that there would be significant demonstrations if it's a decision comes down not to indict?
The long-term solution is going to be having governments be trusted by the citizenry, having the police department have
right.
the confidence of the citizenry. And those are long-term things about, frankly, having your government look like your citizenry in various ways. So there's trust across these divides. So there's going to be difficulty if you have largely white governments and police departments and a largely black community in situations of racial tension and polarization.
Mm-hmm. Email that's come in from John in Stoughton. We have a statute of limitations for almost all crimes. When someone comes to this country illegally, they have broken the law. Why is it that they even if they stay out of trouble and don't break any other laws, they're still prosecuted for what they did many years before?
Well, remember that President Obama's order doesn't give them an automatic right to stay. His successor, if your readers, your listeners want to vote for someone, the Republican candidate who's going to go after these guys, and that person wins in 2016, nothing that Obama has done will prevent that. There isn't a statute of limitations, really. If they're here illegally, what Obama says is, I'm not going to deport them. If, you know, my successor wants to do it, that's up to him or her.
We're talking about immigration, the Affordable Care Act, we'll get to in just a moment, and also the grand jury still deliberating in Ferguson, Missouri this hour. Akhil Reed Amar is our guest, Sterling Professor of Law, Political Science at Yale University. He teaches constitutional law at Yale College and Yale Law School, clerked for Judge Stephen Breyer, U.S. Court of Appeals, and has written a number of books. Our phone number, lines are open on the two issues we've just discussed, 800-486-8655. We'll move to the Affordable Care Act. It's been described as the most serious challenge to President Obama's health care law since it survived that Supreme Court ruling by one vote in 2012. And it centers, my understanding, is on four words in the Affordable Care Act. Is that right?
It's a very clever challenge that you pull this one little thread, and the hope is, by the critics of the law, the entire sleeve falls off. And the basic claim is that various states that have chosen not to set up their own exchanges, but instead have opted to have the federal government run their exchanges for them, in those states, the various subsidies that Obamacare provides for folks can't be paid to citizens who are in states where the federal government is running the exchange for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Supreme Court were to so rule, that would be a bit, perhaps the monkey wrench into
right.
the complicated machine that blows everything up. Or, you know, that's what the metaphor, the thread that when you pull it, the sleeve falls off.
Yeah.
That's their hope. They're hoping to blow up the whole thing. I don't know actually whether that would be true, but that's what they want to do.
Why would the Supreme Court take this case?
Because it's an important legal question. Judges below have disagreed about it. Now, there's not what's called a circuit split yet, because there was a panel in one appellate court that agreed with this critique, this attack on what the administration is doing, but they. Decision was temporarily put on hold so that the entire circuit, this is in Washington, D.C., could hear it. So there's not yet a formal circuit split, but they're the Supreme Court. They should be ruling on important legal questions they may feel.
Mm.
And here's the truth, though.
Yeah, okay.
We don't know. They don't tell us. Just like the grand jury
right.
won't tell us.
Right.
And I'm not criticizing this. But the grand jury doesn't have to tell us why it's not indicting. If it does indict, in effect what they're saying is because we believe there's probable cause, because we believe the person is guilty. But there might be a bunch of reasons that they don't indict, and they don't have to tell us. There are a bunch of reasons that the Supreme Court has for either taking a case or not taking a case, and they don't typically give us the reasons why. They only say once they hear the case, and there's oral argument and opinions, then they tell us what they think on the merits. But they don't usually tell us why they've taken a case or not taken a case.
And Professor Amar, does it really boil down, do you think, of somebody not writing something as specifically as they should have when they were writing the language for the Affordable Care Act? Because it strikes me as obvious that everybody knows what the intent was.
And that's my view, too. I think this is like a very clever person afterwards saying, gotcha, you didn't say Simon Says,
right,
you didn't say
right.
Mother May I, because
right.
No one, the reading that's being put forth saying what that subsidies are impermissible in states where the federal government is running the exchange, that's a reading that not a single senator put forth when the law was being debated, not a single staff person put that forward, not a single journalist said that's what the rule
right.
means. So,
yeah.
So no, they're trying. This is very mischievous. The critics are coming up with a reading that no one in real time put forth. And this wasn't a statute that kind of slipped under the radar. This was being debated out there in public for a year, and no one thought that the statute meant what the plaintiffs are alleging here. But again, they're trying to throw this monkey wrench in to try to blow up the machine.
Yeah. Let's go to Vaughn in Shawano. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, I'm calling about the Ferguson incident.
Okay.
I totally agree that representation, there should be representation of the type of people, or race, or religion, and everything. But from what I understand is that Ferguson in the last two elections was a 5% and 9% turnout in the vote. And if you're not going to vote, you're not going to be representative in this country. And
Amen.
That's the problem, I think, with this country.
Amen.
Is that even when we get a big turnout of 52%, you take 3 to 4% for independents, that means that 24-25% of the population are determining our president, and that, you know, and people need to understand that if they want representation, they need to vote.
Right.
We talk a lot about rights, but there are responsibilities. In my view, there's a responsibility to vote. There's not just freedom of speech. There's actually a duty to listen. Your readers are faithfully discharging that duty. They're actually listening to me, whether they agree with me or not. They're trying to think things through. In order for democracy to work, I think people need to pay attention to public affairs to some extent, need mm-hmm. to listen. Now, government can make that a little easier. Government can make it easy or hard to register to vote. Government can make it easy or hard to actually cast a vote on election day, you know, depending on how many different forms of ID they require. Government, you know, could have early voting if it wants to make it easier, could not have the election only on a Tuesday. There's a campaign saying, you know, you should be able to vote on the weekend before, because people work for a living, and Tuesday isn't always easy for working folks. So on one side, I totally agree with the reader. We have an obligation to show up, and I think on the other side, government has an obligation to try to help us discharge that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Vaughn. And I'm not sure what the voting turn. I'd be interested in knowing if the voting numbers went up in Ferguson for the midterms.
Well, in the world and in American history, you often get very high turnouts actually after outrages. People then start to realize what Vaughn just said. It matters. It makes
yes.
a difference. You know, I have no right to complain if I didn't show up.
Right. Well, it's also a sign, and address this for a moment, of people's being so disengaged from the political process because of money or bickering or not getting anything done that they just figure, I'm just going to sit it out.
They do feel all of that, but at one level, I'm with Vaughn. I'm not that sympathetic. It's our obligation. The government doesn't ask that much of us, but we're supposed to pay our taxes and obey the law. And I heard the other callers, they are offended, and I hear them, that folks haven't obeyed the immigration laws. Okay, fine. Now what do we do with that? Do we have the resources to deport 11 million people, many of whom are the parents of minor children who are citizens and in our schools and all the rest?
Mm-hmm.
But we have obligations to obey the law, to serve on juries and grand juries when summoned, to show up on election day. I even think to listen to NPR and places like that, just so we hear folks on the other side. We actually have an obligation
right.
to hear not just the people who agree with us, but to listen to the folks who disagree with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I'm with you. You got to be engaged. Professor Akhil Reed Amar is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We have these kinds of discussions every Monday. He's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He teaches constitutional law at Yale College and Yale Law School, and we're welcoming phone calls. You can move our conversation in other directions if you want. He is a political science professor as well, but we thought with these three major issues, immigration, the Ferguson grand jury, and the challenge to the Affordable Care Act, that we would have plenty to talk about for the hour, which we do, but feel free to go into other directions if you would like. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon, Kevin. I just had a question to the professor. Professor, even assuming arguendo that the establishment of federal insurance exchanges in states where they've rejected the subsidy constitutes a violation of federal taking a state's power, could not the court uphold the law in those other states which have accepted the subsidy? And on a secondary note, I think it was Bobby Kennedy once said that 6 months is a lifetime in politics. Don't you think that this immigration issue will be lessened by the time the 2016 campaign comes around? Thank you very much. I'll take my
Jim.
Answer off the air.
Sure.
Wow, that's a very sophisticated question. Maybe from a law-trained person, whenever you hear the word arguendo, you know that which is Latin for the sake of argument. So I think 6 months is a very long time, and we're still a couple years away from the next presidential election, so lots could happen in the meantime. Here's the big structural point, that long-term demographics of the two parties are shifting. The Reagan coalition needs to be reinvigorated in various ways, just because it tends to be more male, more white, more elderly than the Democratic coalition. And so long-term, even though the Reagan coalition might have one more presidential victory left in them, unless long-term they make a pivot and get more women and more immigrants and, frankly, Hispanics, because that's a rising demographic group, they have problems for the presidency. They could still continue to win the House of Representatives for a good long time, because the way House districts are drawn Hispanics are not distributed in those districts in the same way that they actually are swing voters in swing electoral college states. So if you care a lot about the presidency and you're a Republican, you understand that long term we're going to need to do something to appeal to Hispanics. Now, that need not necessarily be Obama's immigration reform, but you're going to have to provide something else, your alternative. And Reagan peeled off various ethnic Democrats. We call them Reagan Democrats: Catholic, Italian Americans, Irish Americans. So Reagan faced the FDR coalition and realized he had to peel off certain elements, and he did. Now his coalition needs to be refreshed if it's to win going forward. So long term, Republicans are going to have to figure out a way of appealing to Hispanics. On the technical question about the Affordable Care Act challenge, I think the caller may be right.
Mm. Thanks, Jim, very, very much for your call. Margie in Milwaukee. Hi.
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 I'm hoping that the professor can explain exactly what's up with Jonathan Gruber. I don't understand the comments that he's making, and can you enlighten me? I just don't understand it. And how much impact would that have, his comments, on anything that the Supreme Court decides?
And what comments are worrisome to you, Margie?
He's been saying, I've heard clips where he's said certain things about some things in the Affordable Care Act were done because we could get away with it because the public is so stupid.
Oh, right.
And making it sound, and it's never shown in its entirety. I don't know how, if it's taken out of context, but it gives, and I am a Obama supporter, and I think the Affordable Care Act has saved tons of money. But I don't understand why somebody that helped formulate it would be making such brash, awful statements now.
Yeah, it's a good question. Professor Amar.
We academics say lots of stupid things off the cuff. That includes me, and that includes this fellow.
Now, not you.
Definitely me. I think I probably said some stupid things in the last hour, alas. When I replay it, I'm going to wince. This guy was not a government official. He was an advisor. He's one of many, many different advisors. He's allowed to have his views. But bottom line, there was a law. It had words. We all saw the words. The words were enacted into law. You know, I'm just a bill sitting on Capitol Hill. And we voted with the House and with the Senate, and the president signed it. And that's what we got. And if we were fooled by that, boy, shame on us, because this was one of the biggest pieces of legislation ever to come down the pike, and it was covered by journalists for a very long time in front of all our eyes.
It was covered for a long time.
So this wasn't something passed in the dead of night that no one knew about. So I don't exactly know what Jonathan Gruber meant. I can tell you, quite honestly, this is my view as a political scientist, that the Republicans actually don't quite have an alternative policy on health care. They say repeal and replace, but what are they going to replace it with? They don't actually have an alternative policy on immigration. That's why they don't like what the president is doing, but they haven't quite said what their plan is. If you don't have a policy, you're going to spend all your time trying to get folks to kind of get distracted by other things, whether it's Benghazi or Fast and Furious or, you know, Jonathan Gruber said this or that fellow said the other thing. And it's a way of distracting attention from the fact that you don't quite have a platform. Long term, this is not a winning strategy for the Republican Party. Ronald Reagan actually had things that he stood for, and he united Republicans around it. Long term, you got to actually have a set of policies that you're putting forth.
And do you think the Republicans will do just that?
Eventually, they're going to have to, because they have lost the popular vote in five of the last six presidential elections, and their basic recipe, the Reagan recipe, won't work going forward because, given changing demographics, as I said, it's too old, too male, too white, given changing America. You could still win the House of Representatives for a long time with that recipe, mm-hmm. but you can't actually win the presidency consistently going forward without... Rand Paul, for example, he's very interesting. He realizes, actually, it's very hard to have low taxes and high defense because it just doesn't add up. And so he's saying, well, let's rethink the high defense. That's really interesting. He's an ambitious person, and he's trying to come up with a new winning platform for the Republican Party. You need two things. You need a demographic coalition, and you need a set of policy platforms. And the world has changed since Reagan. The platform doesn't quite work, high tax, a high defense, low tax, and the demographic coalition doesn't quite work going forward. And Karl Rove understands this. The smart Republicans understand this, and going forward, we'll see some new ideas. But for now, they don't quite have their act together. They're divided. That's the Hastert rule. Boehner doesn't want to put things on the floor because they're divided on this, and so they want us to talk about Benghazi and Fast and Furious and IRS scandals and Jonathan Gruber and whatever it is du jour.
Mm-hmm. Margie, thanks for your call. Jerry in Genesee, hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon. I heard an interesting thing the other day that gun sales have skyrocketed around mm-hmm. Ferguson. Two mm-hmm. different gun dealers yep. called in and said that they have never seen such an upsurge of purchase of guns.
Yep.
Obviously, the purchasers have something in mind. If they think there's going to be a riot, they're going to protect themselves.
Yes.
Because most of those people feel that that criminal, young man, budding criminal, as they call him, got shot and the police did their duty. And that's why I'm afraid it's going to come out. And if it does, there's going to be riot and there'll be trouble.
Well, I don't know all the details about the victim, and we should be careful before we, call people budding criminals. But so I just want to be very, very careful about that and maybe not associate myself with that part of the comment, of Vaughn's comment. But the other part of Vaughn's comment, yes, when people are thinking that there may be violence, they're going to protect their homes. And they're going to your audience might think, oh, this is some crazy liberal professor from Yale. I believe in a right to have a gun in the home for self-protection. That's a conservative idea. The Supreme Court in the case called City of Chicago versus McDonald that affirmed that right, Justice Alito actually cited me six times. So I agree with Vaughn that there, even though I don't love guns, they scare me, but there's a right to have a gun in the home for self-protection. And if you can't count on the police forces to maintain law and order, and you may want to have a gun, and I think that doesn't surprise me that lots of folks are buying guns. I wish it weren't so, but that's their right.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry, for the call. One more call, Jerry. Another Jerry, Hamburg.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't born this
day.
That's right. Hi, Jerry.
I'm calling to. I'm calling to basically say the first gentleman who called about immigration seemed to paint with a very broad brush that all these people were criminals.
Right.
Child rapists and everything else. I feel the professor should have corrected him and said most of them are mothers with children who we are discussing. And I feel the Ojibwe might be kind of wondering who the illegal immigrants really are. Thank you very much.
Right.
Great show.
Thank you. Thanks
well,
very much.
Well said, Jerry. I don't like attacking tough questioners, so I sometimes am a little gentler, but my heart, I think, is with yours.
Yeah. Well, sometimes people say things and you just let them stand because you just let them stand. Everybody knows why. Well, I, for one, think you're I'm glad you read a lot of books, and thank you so much. You're lively and always very intelligent, and I love what you said about democracy. We'll use it in a pledge drive. It's just good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Join us again, please.
Happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you, too. Professor Akhil Reed Amar, Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, teaches constitutional law, and he was a clerk for Judge Stephen Breyer, U.S. Court of Appeals, joined the Yale faculty in 1985, and has written a number of leading constitutional law books. And we thank him very much for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in somewhat snowy downtown Milwaukee. Senator John McCain joins us, as will later in the hour the co-author of his book, 13 Soldiers. So join us.